You're listening to NPR on Health. I'm your host, Joe Neal. Most of the stories in today's podcast look at children's health in one way or another. The first is a study of teenagers' risky behaviors. There's some new evidence that risky behaviors are on the rise. Next, we'll hear two stories about trying to make foster care better and reducing the number of problems that foster children have as adults. Then we'll hear a progress report on getting AIDS treatments to people in the developing world, especially efforts to reduce the transmission of HIV from mother to child. After that, we'll hear more about Senator Ted Kennedy's brain operation and the odds of surviving after a diagnosis of brain cancer. And finally, we'll hear about some paradoxical findings in colon cancer. Every 2 years, researchers from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention fan out across the country and ask teenagers about some of their most personal behaviors, everything from sunscreens to sex. Their responses are kept anonymous. This year's survey found some surprises. Risky behaviors may be going up a little bit. We'll start with what the study has to say about sunscreen use and then get to what it says about sex. NPR's Allison Aubrey went out and talked to a group of teenagers about the study's finding that only about 10% of teenagers regularly use sunscreens.
Lots of teenagers know that they're supposed to use sunscreen when they spend time outside, and many of them remember their parents slathering it on. But now that it's up to them, do they bother with it?
Not really.
I used a little bit yesterday, but not today.
I didn't bring any at all.
Does it surprise you that less than 10% of teenagers wear sunscreen in this country?
No.
The 10% figure comes from the CDC's latest survey on teen health behaviors and refers to the percentage who say they use it regularly. Seventh grader Alexa Zelliger is about to turn 13. She says lots of girls just want to be tan, even if it means getting a little sunburned.
You always want to make, like, the right decision, but then also you have, like, another rebellious side of you that, or just the side that, you know, it's kind of a social thing.
Going along with the crowd, Zelliger's teacher, Jason Rosenbaum, says it's a struggle for teenagers to think through all the possible consequences of their actions. In the case of sunscreen, the risk of skin cancer may seem too remote to be real.
The balance between immediate gratification and safety are definitely a struggle.
This holds true for all the decisions that teens go on to make about everything from alcohol and drugs to sex and tobacco. And the CDC's survey on teen behaviors covers them all. Every 2 years, researchers are able to get about 14,000 ninth to 12th graders from all over the country to weigh in on all of their most personal decisions and behaviors. Their responses are kept anonymous. Glenn Flores is a pediatrician and professor at the University of Texas Southwestern. He's reviewed the survey.
Teens constantly face temptations in every part of their life.
And in some spheres, teens are making good choices. Take, for example, tobacco use. It continues to decline among teenagers, though just slightly. About one in four students report using some kind of tobacco. In other ways, the CDC survey shows that many teens are still taking risks. Flores says, take sex, for example. The survey found one in three high school students are sexually active, and 61% of them report that either they or their partner use a condom. This is a slight decrease from the rate of condom use reported 2 years ago. Flores says, for parents who are concerned by these statistics, evidence suggests that it makes good sense to talk early and often to your kids about sex.
There are studies that document that when a teen reports that they're able to talk to their parent about sexual issues and have good communication with their parent, that they're less likely to be sexually active and that they're more likely to use condoms if they're sexually active.
Flores says the reproductive health information that teens or preteens get in school seems to be important, too. Advocates for more comprehensive sex education say teens today just aren't getting enough facts. James Wagner is president of Advocates for Youth.
Right now, the best estimate we have is that around a third of school districts in this country now have an abstinence-only approach. Another third have kind of a mixed bag. that there may be some reference to condoms or birth control, but not a very systematic or comprehensive approach.
So it's the remaining third that are getting the comprehensive approach where abstinence and birth control hold equal sway. Wagner says without accurate information on both, the risks that young people are taking may increase. CDC officials say they're not sure why sexual activity rates are going up a little bit and condom use is going down a little bit after major gains in both categories in the 1990s. They do say if trends continue, they will get concerned. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
I was surprised to learn that on any given day, over 500,000 children in the U.S. are in foster care. These are children who've been separated from their parents and taken out of their homes because the parents were either abusing them or severely neglecting them. Now, foster care programs themselves have a lot of problems. There are good foster care parents and programs out there, but there are a significant number that are producing children that have serious mental and physical disabilities in adulthood. For years, researchers and child advocates have tried to find a way to improve foster care to either minimize or eliminate these problems that kids have in adulthood. A new study in the Archives of General Psychiatry suggests a combination of factors that might work. We have two reports, the first from Michelle Trudeau.
A child is placed in foster care only as a last resort when parental maltreatment or neglect is extreme and unremitting. Such abuse has long-term consequences. Sociologist Ronald Kessler of Harvard Medical School investigated two groups of foster care children from Oregon and Washington State. They were adults who'd been raised in foster care from childhood through their teenage years. One group had been placed in the state-run public foster care system, and the other group was placed in a private program with expanded services.
We traced both groups of kids to see how they turned out as adults.
Both groups had similar social and economic backgrounds. They'd been placed in either the standard state program or the expanded private program, depending on space availability. Kessler says they turned out very differently.
The people who were alumni of the more intensive program had dramatically better mental health and physical health than the people who were in care in the conventional program.
Significantly less hypertension, heart disease, ulcers, chronic pain, and headaches.
They had 50% lower rates of depression and anxiety disorders and substance disorders.
So what made the difference? A whole list of things, including that caseworkers in the private program were better trained, earned higher salaries, had lower caseloads. The kids got more services, such as mental health counseling, tutoring in school, summer camps. And the foster parents received more financial assistance and support, even some parent training. Of course, these expanded services cost more, about 60% more, but Kessler says the benefits outweigh the cost.
The outcomes are more than 60% better. You really get a dramatic, dramatic increase in the quality of the outcomes for the kids in the model program.
But with the foster care system already costing the country well over $5 billion a year, it's perhaps more realistic, Kessler says, to target these expanded services at foster children who are particularly vulnerable.
We're now going in and digging into the data and saying, is there some subset of kids who it really makes a big difference for and others that it doesn't?
Research psychiatrist Charles Nemeroff at Emory University agrees and suggests that the target group should be children who have experienced the trauma of parental abuse and inherited a genetic vulnerability to depression or anxiety. This group would be the most likely to suffer lasting health problems as adults and the most likely to benefit from an expanded, encompassing foster care program. For NPR News, I'm Michelle Trudeau.
I'm Patty Neimand. If kids are to be helped by foster care, they need to be in one home as long as possible. Often their behavior causes foster parents to give up on them. For Freya Gordon, her foster son just wouldn't answer a question in a straightforward way.
We might say, you know, have you brushed your teeth? And he would say, yes, or have I? And like it was a murder mystery or something, and we could never get a straight answer from him about anything.
In San Diego, where Gordon lives, there's a new program to teach foster parents how to cope with problem behavior. For 4 months, Gordon and her partner went to weekly classes.
There were tools out there and there were things out there, that would mean that our kids could have a kind of normal, if you like, life.
The class that taught her the tools was developed by psychologist Joseph Price and colleagues at San Diego State University. Tools like praising kids when they do something well. As Price says, catching kids being good.
Thank you for reminding me. Thank you for putting the dishes in the sink like I asked you to. Thank you for picking up your clothes. That's a big help. So it's very specific reinforcement, and it's not just this kind of general, you know, you're a good boy, you're a good girl, but very focused on the changes that they want to see.
With rewards for the children, too. Gordon says parents were given jars and bags of marbles.
One of the things that we worked on was doing homework, for instance. Always a battleground, and you know, if they came in from school and sat down and got on and did their homework without it being a major battle, then they'd get marbles. They'd earn marbles for that.
At the end of the week, a full jar meant a special treat like time on the computer. But there were also consequences for bad behavior, like marbles or points taken away. No argument about it, says Gordon.
Consistency really is the key. Focus on the positive and be consistent with it.
It clicked so well, Gordon's fostered three boys, now 13, 12, and 9. She and her partner plan to adopt all of them. As for the truth-telling with her son, there's been a turnaround.
If he didn't, we would just take a point away from him. There would be nothing else. And then, you know, by the end of the week, he might not get his Naruto cards or whatever it was that he wanted. Pretty soon, he stopped doing that, and he was able to just tell us what we needed to know.
And for most foster parents who also went to classes, their kids' behavior got better, too. As a result, there were more adoptions and more relatives who agreed to take the children into their homes. Patty Neiman, NPR News.
The World Health Organization has issued a progress report on getting AIDS treatments to people in the developing world. Last year, 3 million people were on treatment. That's a little short of the goal they had set in 2005 of getting that many people on treatment. But they got there last year, and the pace of treatment is picking up, they say. One of the problems ahead is that the pace of prevention is not keeping up, so that many more people are getting infected than are getting treated. And that means that a commitment made by the countries of the G8 to get treatment to everyone by 2010 is probably not going to be met. NPR's Brenda Wilson takes a closer look at where we stand with AIDS treatment around the world.
As the director of HIV/AIDS for the World Health Organization, Dr. Kevin DeCock has a lot of practice in explaining how one should see the proverbial glass as half full.
I think it's a remarkable achievement. Obviously, the target of 3 million has been met 2 years late, which is terrible for people who missed out on therapy and may have lost their lives. At the same time, this is a remarkable achievement when just 4 years ago it was less than 500,000.
Most of that treatment is provided by the U.S. under the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief and by the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, TB, and Malaria, to which other governments make contributions. WHO's monitoring of treatment has been credited by AIDS activists for spurring the push for treatment. In 2004, just 10% of pregnant women with HIV in sub-Saharan Africa mainly were getting treatment to prevent passing the virus to their babies. Now a third of those women who test positive get a dose of the drug during labor. A dose is also given to the baby.
But it's obviously nowhere near enough. The other thing that we're not doing well enough is identifying those pregnant women who require HIV treatment for their own health. They need treatment to stop them from dying in the near future and leaving orphans behind.
The International Treatment Preparedness Coalition has been monitoring efforts to bring HIV treatment to the world's poor. Chris Collins says WHO's report shows what can be achieved when governments, international organizations, and donors work together.
We can be encouraged that the pace of scale-up of treatment delivery increased in 2007. It had been about 700,000 more people each year and moved to 1 million people in 2007. That's certainly the right direction, but not an adequate pace of growth in order to come anywhere near the universal access commitment that the G8 countries and the United Nations has made.
WHO's de Kock says that some countries, like Botswana, for example, are already close to providing universal access. But the vast majority of the countries receiving assistance, and two-thirds of them are in sub-Saharan Africa, will have to build health systems at the same time they scale up treatment, prevention, and care.
Continuing to scale up at this pace, or this increased pace, how long can you keep on doing that? There will come a time when systems give out, if you will, or you just cannot squeeze more out of inadequate numbers of healthcare workers and fragile health systems.
But he says polarizing debates over whether we should be focusing on health systems instead of fighting specific diseases should be avoided. There are more than nearly 10 million people who need treatment now. Only a third of them are getting it. The rest are waiting in line. Even if all of them could get treatment, there is still the prospect of more than 2 million new infections each year. Brenda Wilson, NPR News.
As we've been covering Senator Ted Kennedy's brain operation, we've been learning a lot more about the odds of survival from a brain tumor. This week, Richard Knox reported on Senator Kennedy's operation. His surgeon said that the operation was a success, but we still don't know very much about what kind of tumor he has or what his prognosis might be. Prior to the surgery, Richard, who is based in Boston, went over to Massachusetts General Hospital and talked to some surgeons there about brain tumors and what the progress in this field has been. He also talked to a patient who is still living a healthy life 5 years after her diagnosis with the disease.
One of the doctors who will play a big role in Kennedy's care at Massachusetts General Hospital is Tracy Batchelor, a brain tumor specialist. Batchelor isn't happy about the gloomy picture many have painted about Kennedy's future.
Many have been upset, and really this has provoked a lot of anxiety in many patients.
Batchelor says things aren't always as bad as they used to be for patients like Kennedy. He goes to his computer and punches up a scan from another of his patients. Like Kennedy, Janice Durham was also diagnosed with a malignant glioma.
So what we're looking at here is one of the initial scans that Janice had when she came under our care.
It shows a golf ball-sized glioma in the frontal lobe of her brain. Durham remembers the day when she had her first scan. She could hardly absorb the news.
They came out and they were ashen-faced and said that I had a mass in my brain and I need to find a neurosurgeon. And the next day I was supposed to do a stress management workshop and get the oil changed in my van. So I sort of said, okay, I've got to get the oil changed in the van, do a stress management workshop, and find a neurosurgeon.
As it happened, Durham canceled that workshop and didn't get the oil change. Unlike Kennedy, she didn't have surgery. Doctors said her glioma was too wrapped around vital brain structures for surgeons to operate. Durham's husband, Stephen Sadek, says the message they got was as gloomy as it could be.
One of the doctors that we talked with at Mass General said, there is no hope. There is no hope. Everybody dies of this.
But what else could she do? With two adolescents at home, Durham embarked on a treatment course that is similar to the one that Kennedy will probably get. But unlike Durham, the senator will probably get radiation and chemotherapy at the same time instead of one after another. Recent evidence suggests that prolongs survival. Durham's response to radiation and chemotherapy was spectacular. After a year's treatment, she and her husband went to Batchelor to hear the results of her latest MRI scan.
He came in and he said that the MRI looked good, and we said, so what, like how big is it, what's left? And he said, well, there's nothing left. And we said, well, what do you mean there's nothing left? And he said, well, it's all dead tissue, there's no active tumor anymore. So we were just sort of stunned, completely stunned.
Janice Durham is now doing fine 5 years after she got malignant glioma. She has one big advantage over Kennedy. She was 50 when she got her diagnosis, 26 years younger than Kennedy is. Even so, experts say it's impossible to know if Kennedy will be among those who outlive the usual expectations. Richard Knox, NPR News, Boston.
And now a quick update on colon cancer. Researchers have found a paradox. It looks like the same genetics that make people prone to colon cancer may also make it more likely that the treatment will be successful. NPR's Joanne Silberner explains.
Researchers at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston asked 1,100 people with fairly advanced colon cancer whether their parents or siblings had ever had colon cancer. All the patients were treated with one of two types of chemotherapy. The researchers checked on the patients 5.5 years later. Regardless of which chemotherapy they were on, people with one relative with colon cancer had a 23% lower risk of the cancer coming back or killing them than people with no family history. And people with two relatives were even better off. Their risk was 51% lower. The researchers can't explain why a family history of colon cancer would improve a patient's prospects. They report their findings in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Joanne Silberner, NPR News.
That's it for this podcast. You can hear more health stories by tuning into your local NPR station. You can find a list of them at our website, npr.org. While you're there, you can find more health and science stories by clicking on the link over on the left side of the page. Thanks for listening. I'm Joe Neal, NPR News.